Okay, so just as a quick reminder, tomorrow you've got two doses of Alyosha at 9 and 10:45. And on Thursday, you'll have two doses of me at 9 and 10:15. So on Thursday, we're going to be looking at the gravitational action and boundary terms, because I thought that made quite a nice topic to do, you know, in a sort of double slot. And today I wanted to sort of come back on the theme of black holes. So I'm going to start off by returning to the geodesic equation, because I want to kind of talk about geodesics around black holes. And then I thought another fun thing that we could do is also think about what changes if we didn't live in four dimensions. So that's almost like just for fun. But part of that is going to be as a means of seeing just how powerful and helpful that Cartan formalism can be. So we'll also kind of derive a rather general curvature, or rather general metric and its curvature, which we'll use again at some point. And it'll, you know, in part to illustrate the usefulness of Cartan. So the boards are now dry, or this one is. So I thought I'd call a lecture Black Holes and Beyond. So I want to pick up from yesterday when we were thinking about what meant, you know, what the event horizon was and how we could, you know, if we were being particularly pedantic about it, how we could derive it by looking at null geodesics that escaped. So as part of that, we got this geodesic equation. Which I wrote in this form, r dot squared plus some sort of effective potential was zero. And our effective potential was eta minus p squared over minus grr. So if you remember, we took eta to be zero because that was a null geodesic. Eta is the normalized length of the tangent vector of the geodesic. So if instead we want to think about time-like orbits or orbits of particles around black holes, we have to put eta equals one. So if I keep our V, if I inputted my potentials from the Kerr metric, so I put absolutely everything in, this is what I got. So yesterday we had eta equals zero, so some of these terms weren't there. In particular, the 1 over r piece wasn't there. So if I kind of go through and just think about what each of these bits are doing, this bit is of order 1. It's a constant, and it's just like setting a zero for the effective potential. So if you like, it's a calibration. The next bit is 2gm on r for eta is 1. So this piece, minus 2gm on r, this is our Newtonian, if you like, attraction. So a minus 1 on r is like our Newtonian potential for gravity. That's attractive. This 1 over r squared piece positive, it's repulsive. And so this is like your centrifugal force, or centrifugal repulsion. And then the final bit, so this, at least without the A, if you were just in Schwarzschild and had no A, that would be your geodesic equation for orbiting planets in Newtonian gravity. So it's this last piece that is the truly Einstein piece and gives you deviations from Newtonian gravity. So if I sketch my potential, I first get the 1 over r negative, then I get the 1 over r squared positive, then I get the 1 over r cubed negative. So broadly speaking, this is what my potential looks like. This is, of course, just a sketch. But this bit here is where your 1 over r dominates. This, broadly speaking, is when the 1 over r squared dominates. And this, broadly speaking, is where the 1 over r cubed is the important piece. So this already allows us to make some qualitative statements about what happens in gravity and what the possible solutions are for particle orbits. Now, I've zeroed this here so that, I mean, I had to draw a line just to sort of set. So this would be where eta minus e squared was zero, but this, essentially, this zero line is this calibration. So this is, you know, your particle, the level of energy of the particle is really determined by where that zero line is. So for example, if my energy is somewhere down here, so if I draw my eta minus e squared down, then that tells me that my r dot squared plus v effective has to be zero. So r dot squared is sort of given by, you know, if this is when my effective potential is zero, this is where r dot squared is zero, and my r dot squared can only be non-zero in between these two points. So it tells me that I have a range of r, so I can sort of look R1 and R2. So the motion that I have goes between R1 and R2 because R dot squared can only be positive when V effective is negative. So if I slide this zero down, then this would be, so this corresponds to an elliptical orbit. Okay. So obviously I can solve my geodesic equation, but it's only sort of in certain cases that it has, because of this extra GR piece, that it has a nice closed form solution. So it's, but I can still say qualitatively what happens. So the other, I want to keep sketching on that thing. So the other interesting points are at the turning points of the potential when I get a circular orbit. So at these points, R doesn't change, so that R dot is always zero, but obviously that doesn't mean that the particle is at rest because we still have an R squared phi dot. So at these points, our particle is going round the black hole in an exactly circular motion. If I have, on the other hand, So I move my eta minus e squared higher, I find that the particle can come in from infinity up to some r naught and then go back out again, and that's a scattering orbit. So here, this is my eta minus e squared, this is my r naught, this is a scattering orbit. So obviously this circular orbit is not stable. Then the real difference with Newtonian gravity is, of course, that for Newtonian gravity, this curve just keeps going up, but in general relativity, it turns over again. And what that means really is that if you end up getting too close to a black hole, you fall in. There's no escape. That's essentially what that's saying. So we know what the qualitative set or family of solutions for particles around a black hole is. We have scattering orbits, so we have particles that never get close enough to be captured. We have bound orbits, which can be elliptical or circular. And then we have the sort of plunge orbits, if you like, those that get too close and get sucked in. So what happens around a black hole? Well, generally, the matter sort of all gets sucked in towards the black hole and forms an accretion disk over time. And that tends to be, broadly speaking, located around the equatorial plane of the spinning black hole. And so gradually, the matter is sort of, you know, you have a lot of matter in orbit, tends to get heated up, it dissipates its energy, and gradually falls inwards as it loses energy into ever sort of closer orbits to the black hole until eventually it's sucked in. So we can model this simply, if we want to be simplistic, and even though this is simplistic, it's actually a pretty good representation of what's going to happen once the disk has stabilized. And so there's enough time for all the energy to have been sort of evened out and dissipated. And so you have a sort of steady state of matter sort of being accreted and gradually being sucked in. So there is the innermost part of the accretion disk. Is kind of a marginally stable orbit. So unless we have an extremal Kerr black hole, we cannot get arbitrarily close, we cannot orbit arbitrarily close to the event horizon in a stable fashion. So the sketch that I did up there is really just meant to be a sort of cartoon of what actually happens. As you get more and more angular momentum, your kind of the maximum and the minimum there start coming closer together until they just about disappear. So we have this sort of sequence of curves where we've got, you know, our distinctive maximum and minimum. We then have a very close maximum and minimum. And then we get an inflection point. And then there's no, it's just a simple plunge curve. So this marginally stable orbit called the innermost stable circular orbit. Or ISCO for short. So the reason the ISCO is important is it's kind of the most energetic orbit. And so it's the last gasp of anything before it gets sucked into the black hole. And it's kind of where the most of energy or photons, if you like, come from the in the accretion disk. So it's the hottest part of the accretion disk. So in general, our circular orbit is characterized by V equals V prime to zero. So V is zero, so that R dot squared remains zero. And then V prime to zero, because if it wasn't, R dot would then start to become non-zero. So if V double primed is positive, this is stable. If it's negative, it is unstable. And so our marginal case, our innermost stable circular orbit, has V double primed equals zero. So we have V equals V primed equals V double primed equals zero. So that's a lot of constraints, and it allows us to find the radius of that innermost stable circular orbit. So to keep the algebra simple, we'll just look at an example for Schwarzschild. So that's our potential. Setting A to zero, that's sort of quite straightforward. And so if I take various combinations of V primed and V double prime, both of which are zero, so when I take derivatives, I've really just got these three pieces in different ratios. So the first derivative just has this still being 2gm, then I've got plus 2h squared, then I've got minus 6gm on r to the fourth. And then when I take another derivative, I've now multiplied this term by 2, this term by 6, and this term by 12. So they're all different ratios of those three terms, and I can just kind of take various combinations. So I can see that between them, these two constraints tell me that r squared is 3h squared from this one, and this one tells me that r is h squared over 2gm. So putting those together, that tells me that h squared is 12 g squared m squared, and r is 6 gm. So that's my innermost stable circular orbit for Schwarzschild. I cannot rotate, I cannot orbit a black hole any closer. Not in an inertial, not along a geodesic anyway. Of course I can if I have powerful rockets. So if you have a Kerr black hole, then of course you have the point you can counter-rotate or co-rotate. Co-rotating is more stable. And you can do exactly the same calculation, but it's much more, you know, algebraic. There's a lot more algebraical junk going on there. So if you want to play with it, pull out Mathematica and just tell it to do all the work for you. And you will see that as the black hole starts to rotate, the co-rotating in a most stable orbit moves in, and the counter-rotating one moves out. And as you tend to the extremal limit, the ISCO actually moves right in to touch the event horizon itself. So you have the fact that a very rapidly spinning black hole has an accretion disk that can get very, very close to the event horizon. And so that tells you that's going to be an extremely hot and sort of very violent place. So that sort of gives us at least a little bit of a feel for what goes on in our accretion disk. So we have this picture of our accretion disk, which the traditional artist's impression would be something like this. And if you like, what that is literally drawing the geometry. If I put down the coordinates and added in my sort of phi angle, so I have my black hole, then you know the accretion disk would be largely localized around the equatorial plane, and it would be lying in the equatorial plane. So that's where it is. But of course, that's not what we see, which is much more like, and I'm not going to be up because I'm such a rubbish drawer, but what we actually see is something more like this, where we actually see behind the black hole. So we sort of see this little annulus distorted and lifted up. So I would call this the interstellar. Which is actually what you would see if you were near a black hole. So this is a very simplistic picture. I've done what I can sort of easily algebraically, but it's, you know, you can get various levels of sophistication of this of that picture. You can, if you want to just image a ring, say one of the circular orbits around the black hole, all you do is you say, well, we're looking from this plane here, and then you simply ray trace back. You follow a null geodesic back from where we are, and you trace all these null geodesics back to the environment of the black hole, and then you say, if it hits that circle around the black hole, then you color your pixel in. So you kind of start off with I sketch it. This is where we are. So you ray trace back round to the black hole. And then if you hit the ring, so this is, you know, the geometry. If you hit the ring, you color your pixel in. And so that's how you build up one of these images of a circle. So that's the that's kind of the bare bones mathematical way of doing it. But of course, if you want to sort of ask what you really see, you also have to think about the color of the photon and, you know, all the other redshifting, I guess that's part of the color, and all the other sorts of interactions that can go on. So what you saw in Interstellar was like the full Monty, where everything had been taken into account. But, you know, you can actually sort of get some bare bones pictures without too much effort. The other thing, of course, is, you know, these are all geometric pictures about what we see or how we might calculate what we see around a black hole. But then you have the additional complexity of how do you observe what you see around a black hole. So I just wanted to say a few words, at least, about the Event Horizon Telescope, since one of the perimeter, associate faculty has been, you know, one of the leaders in that effort. So those guys had a really, really hard job because, again, you know, when we do things mathematically, we have such control and we sort of imagine we know everything arbitrarily precisely. But if you're actually trying to observe something, then you've got the problem of the resolution of your telescope, which is dependent on the wavelength of what you are observing in. And so for radio astronomy, that's a very long wavelength. And so what's really impressive about the Event Horizon Telescope, well, there's quite a lot that's impressive, but was the clever way that they used the whole, you know, essentially the Earth as a baseline by having different telescopes using data from various locations around the globe, but also the way that they kind of built up the image, because they didn't have the whole Earth as a radio telescope. They were only just getting little bits. But of course, they were observing continuously. So you kind of gradually sort of fill in, if you like, the radio dish. And then you have to match that to a calculation, which is essentially based on what we've done here, though obviously much more sophisticated. So that was a really, really amazing feat, what they did, both from the perspective of actual observation, sort of collecting the data, but also in terms of data analysis. And I think that's kind of the real sort of change over the past sort of, I don't know, 30 years or so. It's not just about collecting data, it's now become about data processing and how we can be clever in terms of processing what we see and interpreting it. So I do highly recommend that you kind of look up and read a little bit into the Event Horizon Telescope, because I think it's really nice. What was so funny, though, was they did the live broadcast of the announcing the, you know, the results in here at Perimeter. And, you know, all of us who are sort of the hardcore scientists are going, ooh, ah, you know, when we see the images, and then one of the media, why are the images so fuzzy? And it's like, ah. It's just quite funny, you know. We're like the little kids there, and they're all the critical ones. Okay, so a bit of a change of gear. That was more on black holes, so let's have a look at beyond. So I want to just take a slight excursion now in a way very much from the practical and very much into the whimsical or a what-if category. So what if there were more than four dimensions? So my aim for the rest of the time is to get a solution for a black hole in more than four dimensions. But I'm going to, first of all, be a little bit more general than I need to. So I'm going to say we live in D, which is P plus N plus two dimensions. And I'm going to write my metric. In the following way. So it's the sort of general calculation that I did want to do anyway, and now is as good a time as any. And it's also a means of giving a demonstration of how Cartan can really make your life a lot easier. So what are P and N? Well, this thing here, so actually let me put it underneath. So this is going to be delta ij omega I alpha omega j beta dy alpha dy beta, and put it in another color. Alpha and beta are going to run, and I and j are going to run from 1 to n. So n is the dimensionality of the y space. This thing here is very similar. It's going to be eta ab, omega a mu, omega b nu, omega naught, I should say, dx mu, dx nu. So the idea here is the space only depends on a single coordinate, a radial coordinate, and I'm splitting it into two distinct pieces. So this piece here is some spatial part that may or may not be an n-sphere. And this part here is a Lorentzian part that could be just dt squared, or maybe it's actually some sort of brain, okay? So that this is p plus one dimensional. So my I's, J's, alphas, betas are always going to refer to Y, that the spatial bit, and the mu's and A's are going to refer to the first bit, the time-like or Lorentzian bit.
Assumption that make you can that write down this symmetry, is it any symmetry?
So at the moment I'm just saying I want to find, at the moment I'm just saying this is my geometry, okay? And what this geometry might describe. So when we look for when we did this in four dimensions, we had a definite physical agenda. We were interested in describing a star or a black hole. So we knew that, broadly speaking, stars were round, and therefore, although in detail they may be a bit different, in broadly speaking, if you, you know, kind of blurred them enough, they have an SO3 symmetry. So in that case, our physics told us we have an SO3 group of Killing vectors. And then we found what the metric looked like, okay? So here, I'm not starting from looking for a particular solution. I'm not starting from that perspective. I'm starting from the perspective of, here's a geometry. Let me find its Einstein tensor. Then I'm going to think about possible applications. So today, when I come to an application, I'm going to just look at higher dimensional black holes, but I could be interested in a brain, some sort of wall or string, in which case the g mu nu bit at the start would then be non-trivial. And then whether this was just some sort of flat type metric or something else would depend on the context of the physical problem I was trying to solve. So at the moment, I'm coming at this not from addressing a physical question, I'm coming at it from saying, here is a mathematical geometry. I want to calculate the curvature because I know that actually in future, quite a lot of the solutions I'm going to be interested in are going to reduce to this form. So this is something that's quite generic at the moment, or it's reasonably generic. I mean, there's no cross terms, but it's actually reasonably generic and is going to cover a lot of situations of physical interest. Whether it has SON symmetry or whatever will depend on the properties of these tensors. So I isolate my one-form basis. And each of the G and the gamma has an orthonormal basis, so I simply build my orthonormal basis from those. So I'm going to take a bit more time with the first calculation, and then you'll see most of the rest proceed by analogy. So to calculate the connection, I just take the exterior derivative of the basis of one forms. So d of omega a is a primed dr wedge d omega naught plus a d of omega naught. So I'm using the Leibnizian property of d there. So my dr is already omega r, and my omega naught is just 1 on a omega a. So that's my first bit. And then the second bit, well, I know what d of omega naught is. It's simply theta naught ab cross omega naught b. So that's my next step in the calculation. But then I want to write this as something wedge omega b. So I pull out, I've got minus a primed on a omega a. And then I've got minus theta naught a b. Oh, sorry, wedge omega r. So this A combines with that omega naught to give me omega, and I just swap the order of the forms here. So that means I can read off my connection. So I get theta A hat B hat is theta naught A hat B hat plus A primed on A omega A hat. Sorry, what am I talking about? That's not right. That gives me theta A hat R hat. There we go. So I now have the connection components for this first block of the metric. So I don't have any cross terms between the x's and the y's at this level. And I can see that my calculation for the y part of the metric is going to go through pretty much the same way. So I get that theta I hat j hat is theta naught I hat j hat, and theta I hat r hat is c primed on c omega I hat. So I've finished calculating the connection. Now for the curvature. So I write down Cartan's second structural equation, and I sort of then have to go through. So I know that my theta ABs are just theta naught ABs, so I can put that in there. And then my theta AR is simply the A primed on A term. So this just turns out to be R naught A hat B hat plus A primed on A squared omega A cross omega B. So here, rather than, I think when I did it with the four-dimensional case, because everything was so explicit, I didn't, when I sort of took theta R and then, you know, sort of theta upstairs, R downstairs, and I wanted R upstairs, theta downstairs, I left my index on the one form, omega theta upstairs here, omega B downstairs, is eta B C omega C. So there's a sort of a hidden minus sign there.
Sorry, is it the eta matrix all minus one?
Sorry?
Is it mean eta matrix all minus one, or there is only one minus one?
No, they start my convention is plus minus minus minus.
Oh, I mean only one plus.
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this is my next two form. So d theta ar, well, that is just, this is simply a primed omega naught. So I get an a double primed dr wedge omega naught a plus a primed d of omega naught a. And then I've got plus a primed theta naught a hat b hat wedge omega b hat. So that's using this one here. So now if I look at these last two terms, this is simply, these last two terms are simply Cartan's first structural equation. So they cancel each other out. And I end up with a double primed on a omega r cross omega a. And then finally, for the A's, I've got this time, I do have some crosstalk between the X and Y spaces. So I had to do a bit of work to get that, but it wasn't sort of too hard. But then I can just take over by analogy. Essentially the same argument. So I don't need to work to get the Y parts because there's no real difference between the two, the X and Y subspaces. So I just want to note here that when I take the I index downstairs, that's minus delta ij omega j hat upstairs, because you're using the d-dimensional eta to raise and lower indices. Okay, so...
Sorry, what's the superscript on the C in the first line?
C prime squared. Okay, so we need to read off Riemann. For Riemann, we recall the definition of the curvature 2 form, but we just have to be a little careful when we're peeling off the first bit, this R naught bit, because R naught is a half Riemann components times omega naught wedge omega naught, whereas we want the components where it's omega wedge omega. So what this means is that we get various sort of additional factors of 1 over a squared or 1 over c squared floating around. So I'm just going to denote the R naught here by Rg. That is the curvature of g mean u. Given it was unclear what the superscript was there, I'm going to write it that way. So when I peel off my curvature 2 form, I see I have something that comes from the intrinsic curvature in that G subspace, and I've got the a prime and a squared piece. I've also raised the index just for convenience. So that's the curvature bits of A, the A function. So once again, I don't have to work to find the y part of Riemann, because I can just do it by replacing a with c here, and then my ir jr is c double primed on c delta ij. Finally, that's the crosstalk in turn. So I found the Riemann tensor of that general metric with really quite very little pain. So I think this is quite a good illustration of how powerful that Cartan formalism can be. For the four-dimensional spherically symmetric metric, it perhaps wasn't quite so clear because, well, I still think it was fairly obviously faster than using Christoffel's, but I think here you see how it helps when you don't know the dimension of things and you're just sort of trying to find sort of the way things fit together. Oh, I've still got some space on that. So having done it this way, it's quite easy to get to coordinate bases. And so when we do that, because essentially for every index that's up, there's one that's down, so I can just peel the hats off these indices. So I then trace to get my Ricci. So my R mu nu, I simply trace this. So I've got 1 on A squared R of G mu nu. And then from here, I get P A prime squared on A squared times delta mu nu. So Ricci is simply trace over A and C. So if I sum over A and C, I get P plus 1 from this term, delta BD, minus 1 delta BD. So that's my R mu nu, my R alpha beta is very similarly I've just traced that and there's some more. My apologies, I just traced this top bit. If I want R mu nu, I've also got to add this piece in because this is tracing with the R, and then I have to add tracing over I and J here. And then I get the same for alpha and beta, but swapping A and C. Okay, so that's my final Ricci tensor. So now I have to decide what am I interested in finding and what are those background curvatures of gamma or G. So what we typically do is we tend to be interested in spaces, coming back to the question, that have specific symmetry like SO3, SON or whatever. And what that corresponds to, usually, is some sort of constant curvature space. So if we have a constant positive curvature space of dimension n, that's an SON group of Killing symmetries. So what that means is that their Riemann tensors, so for example, R alpha beta gamma delta is minus kappa C So it's saying that the Riemann tensor is just a composite of copies of the metric tensor. So if we say what is, this is now kappa, so that is what our Ricci tensor is. So this is a constant curvature space. So the minus signs are there because simply because it's Lorentzian. So what I end up with, therefore, and RRR is just the same. So that's the contribution that it gives. So in our example, when D was 4, N was 2, P was 0, you see that, and kappa is 1, you see here that you're getting that minus 1 over C squared term that we got. So let's look at our black hole. In D dimensions. So that means P is 0, N is D minus 2, and kappa gamma is 1, because we want a sphere. So we'd also like to transform to the area gauge. Means we have to let C go to rho, and dr is equal to B of rho d rho. So that's how we go from the method that we've just been working with to the area gauge. So it's quite straightforward to do the transformation. So if every time you see a d squared by dr squared, that turns into a 1 on b squared, d squared by d rho squared, and then you get a minus b prime on b, sort of d by d rho. this is what you get when you've shifted to the area gauge. So hopefully that looks slightly more like what we found when we did the four-dimensional black hole. So notice that RTT minus RO rho has a very familiar form. So if we're in, if we have no matter around, that tells us that B is 1 on A. Meanwhile, GTT GTT, the time-time component of the Einstein tensor, it actually has a very similar composition to what we found when we did our four-dimensional metric. So we see that source, I just want to do this so I can derive the correct relationship between an integration constant and the mass. If we have some sort of matter source, this is what we would get from our T naught naught or G naught naught equation, which we can integrate up. This is nice. This just integrates straight up, and we get B to the minus 2 is 1 minus 16 pi G over d minus 2, the integral of rho to the d minus 2 t naught naught. So you see, this is just like our energy between rho and rho plus d rho. And so this thing here is 1 over the area of the d minus 2 sphere times some sort of function, mass function of rho. So that tells us how our mass is related to the integration constant, because if I didn't have a T naught naught, I would integrate up this and I would see that was rho to the D minus 3 plus a constant. And so my vacuum solution is 1 minus rho plus on rho to the D minus 3.
Line.
I'm sorry?
How the last line comes out?
If I integrate up. So I integrate the top line, there's no T naught naught. I get rho to the D minus 3 plus a constant. I'm choosing to express that constant as minus rho plus to the D minus 3. And so when I divide through both sides by rho to the d minus 3, I get 1 minus some constant over rho to the d minus 3. So I've just integrated up the top line in the absence of a t naught naught. And so my mass here, my mass, if you like, you know, m is, m. So that tells me how to extract the mass from that integration constant. It's just it looks very different to Schwarzschild. So in Schwarzschild, you have, d minus 3 is 1. You have a direct relation between m and the horizon radius, whereas in higher dimensions, m is related to horizon radius squared, cubed, and so on. So it is quite different. So just for fun, to finish off, let me come back to this geodesic equation. So here, my V effective of R, remember, is eta minus P squared over B squared. And here, my P squared is A squared T dot squared minus R squared phi dot squared. I still have R squared phi dot as H and A squared T dot as E. So I get my effective potential is eta minus E squared what changes. I still have the centrifugal term, but now my so-called Newtonian term is suppressed by a larger power of R. And so unless you're in D equals 5, this is the dominant term. So what that means is there's no stable orbits. So it's sort of like one of these interesting things that we can only have solar system in four dimensions, four space-time dimensions. So it's sort of the same thing that if we weren't in three spatial dimensions, we'd fall over our shoelaces because the knots wouldn't hold. But there's all these sort of funny things about how many spatial dimensions we live in. So here's a rather cute example of why it's nice to live in three space dimensions. Okay, so I see you next on Thursday.